Welcome to your supplemental sessions, Senate Election and Ethics Committee. We are waiting for the good senator from John Day to arrive before we adopt rules. Hopefully Margie will not let us get any further than gaveling out before we adopt the rules. In the meanwhile, I'd like to go ahead and start on the public hearing in a subcommittee on Senate Bill 1102 and invite Senators Avakian and Senator Wannabe, Representative Boquist, up to the dais. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Madam Chair, I'll take that as a compliment.
I wouldn't take anything I say as a compliment, but that's okay. I'm going to ask Ms. Dudley to come up in a minute. And then I know a number of you testified at in Gresham, and so we probably have enough time for you to do brief remarks, 1 to 2 minutes. I think that would be appropriate. So, Senator Avakian, Representative Boquist, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also testified, and we'll keep that in mind. The first thing I want to do, though, is let you know that you have a couple amendments in front of you. The Dash 1 amendments are the ones that I would ask the committee to adopt. They're a technical fix to the bill. The original language in the bill could leave the extreme possibility that a name could be on the ballot without a party affiliation. This just fixes that. So I'd ask you to adopt the Dash 1s.
Senator Avakian, just to clarify for the audience concerns, this means that the bill would go into effect on January 1st of 2009. Is that correct?
The Dash 1s do, nor the original bill, do not include an emergency clause or any other language that would have it go into effect before January 1st of 2009. That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Terrific bill. Takes us back to our original roots in Oregon when people had a great deal of choice in who they voted for and how they voted for them. And you have a House Republican and a Senate Democrat here that would love to see that kind of bipartisan or nonpartisan choice in today's election system. And I will leave it at that and let Representative Boquist testify.
I could do it again. It was really fun the first time, but I won't. Welcome, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is I don't want to make this a habit because the last time I was before you, I was with Senator Carter, and so it's not real good in my district all the time for this. Having said that, and all joking aside, Senators, Madam Chair, I mean, this bill is really about statesmanship. This bill is about democracy, and this bill is about bipartisanship. And I know Senator Manas Anderson and Representative Minnis and Lim are co-sponsoring SB 1074. I know that Senator Farioli and Senator Walker are co-sponsoring SB 1099. My point is that representatives, senators, parties, and candidates cooperate together when there's a good idea all the time. It's been an Oregon tradition back from the very first legislature that President Courtney likes to talk about, where I like to talk about the wolf part. Having said that, it's a personal choice of an individual or a candidate to choose whether they're going to be bipartisan. This bill simply allows the candidates the same rights that we elected representatives have in this building, at least on your side sometimes, and this bill is well beyond its time in my mind. It's a case where what we need to do is unite everybody in Oregon, and if that means we have to start at the grassroots when we start campaigning, I'm all for it, and I urge your passage of this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? You're off the hook. Thanks, both of you, very much. All right. Professor Dudley, Mr. Peralta, Mr. Burke.
Very short.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Manas Anderson, for hearing us yet again. You have heard all that I have to say about why fusion is such a good idea and what all the other people who will testify have to say about that as well. So I want to address briefly some of the opposition that has come to this bill. So far, the only articulated opposition to fusion voting has come from the Association of County Clerks. Their objections have centered around the cost of implementation. Senator Farioli. the clerk's worry that some voters might ignore instructions on the ballot if we have fusion voting and vote twice for the same candidate. In other states where fusion is used, the voting software automatically counts this double vote as one vote for the candidate. The county clerks here in Oregon estimate that an upgrade of our voting software to deal with double votes might cost up to $1.25 million. We believe that figure could be significantly lower, but in the absence of an analysis from the Legislative Fiscal Office, we did our own study, which you have received. You have it on record, and I will not go through those findings again. Fortunately, however, we do not have to argue about that particular figure, and here's why. I believe that everyone agrees that if the upgrade of Oregon voting software to automatically count any fusion double votes were made over the course of time, as routine upgrades of voting software and hardware are done by the counties, there would be only a minimal added cost. In the meantime, the voting software that the Oregon counties currently use would reject such a ballot where there was a double vote, and it would, as a matter of routine, be examined and counted by hand. This already happens when a voter, under the present system, fills in an oval for more than one candidate for an office. The Clerks Association has given us an estimate that the transition to fusion voting without an upgrade in the voting software could increase the number of overvotes requiring hand counting from the current average of 1% to 5%, at least in the first fusion elections. We think that number might be high given the experience in other states, but even if we accept that 5% figure by the clerk's own estimate, this would cost statewide an additional $59,253 per election. That's statewide. Since fusion voting only applies to general elections and not to primaries, this would be a maximum annual cost in an election year of no more than $60,000 statewide, ranging from a few hundred dollars in the smaller counties to a few thousand dollars in the larger counties. This relatively modest expense could perhaps be covered in part through grants from the Secretary of State if the counties could not handle those modest costs. Another potential cost cited by Secretary of State's office is that of voter education. As we have said before, we believe that voters in Oregon are as smart as they are in any of the states using fusion, and our voter pamphlet and our vote-by-mail system give us a very good opportunity to educate our voters about what we're doing, to explain to them they vote once for a candidate, and eliminate most of this danger of overvotes. So, with that, we get back to why we think this is a good idea at a very, very modest cost. Fusion voting helps build coalitions among different types of voters and among candidates. It's a relatively simple election reform which can increase civic participation among disaffected voters. It helps build electoral coalitions, and it gives voters a way to express themselves on issues without wasting their vote or acting as spoilers. It's good public policy. So I urge you to support this bill and bring fusion voting back to Oregon, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have on anything.
Thank you. Go ahead. Let's finish the panel. No good questions.
Okay. Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, hi. Senator Amaris Anderson, good to see you again. My name, for the record, is Richard Burke. I represent the Ballot Access Project. I was executive director of the Libertarian Party of Oregon for 6 years, which is why I'm still very interested in this bill. Every 2 years when I was executive director, I would get phone calls, usually from Republicans, and they would say, you know, we have good candidates running here, good candidates running there. They work well with libertarians. Libertarians work well with them. We'd hate to see a spoiler ruin it. And I know that Democrats in the past have made similar calls to members of the Pacific Green Party. And I would often have the same response. It's like, I'm sorry, I can't, you know, there's no way we can endorse you, because law doesn't allow it. My rank and file demands a presence on the ballot. And if we cross-nominate, we won't have one, because under current law, the candidate has to pick which party will appear. Well, that would cause us to nominate more candidates than we otherwise would, wasting our resources, and the same was true of the Pacific Green Party on occasion, and it would create more what I call pure spoilers, people who really aren't running serious campaigns but would cause the election to be tilted one way or the other. Oregon voters want reforms that will preserve the rights of everyone, but will also encourage opportunities to bring people together. And there have been a number of ballot reforms proposed. This one, I believe, is the best reform. And here is why. This is the only reform that gives options to everyone, but doesn't force anybody to do anything. With respect to political parties, they may cross-nominate and have a presence on the ballot. They have that new choice. But they don't have to do it if they don't want to. If you're a candidate and you get more than one nomination, you can accept them or reject them. If you accept them, they appear on the ballot. If you reject them, they do not. Again, candidates have choices, but they're not forced to do anything. And voters have more choices. They can either vote for Senator Farioli as before on the Republican ticket, or they could vote on another party ticket to maybe send him a message, but he still gets the vote. Again, the voter has more choices, but isn't forced to do anything. And with more choices for all, forcing nothing reduces pure spoilers and allows multiple parties to come together around good people. This, to me, seems to be a reform that will show the people of Oregon that the legislature is responsive to their desires for less partisanship, responsive to their desires for mechanisms that will allow people to come together around good candidates. And this has worked in other states. One of the most significant criticisms I've heard of this bill is that it might be confusing. Well, you know, other states have fusion voting now. Best known, of course, is New York. Well, they're not confused. You know, and I refuse to believe that when you cross the border into the state of Oregon, people's IQ suddenly drops by 20 points, or that people in Oregon are inherently confused. You know, I just don't believe it. So if these other states can do it, Oregon can do it too. And so I would say this is a good, positive bill. I would encourage you to advance it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Peralta.
Thank you. Madam Chair, distinguished senators, Mona Sanderson, Senator Farioli. My name is Sal Peralta, and I'm here speaking today on behalf of the Independent Party. The Independent Party began in response to legislation that passed in 2005 that made it more difficult to get on the ballot as an independent candidate here in Oregon. The party was formed after citizen activists collected 26,000 signatures during 2006. The party was officially recognized by the Secretary of State in January 2007, and its primary mission is to provide ballot access to independent candidates and to help enfranchise Oregon's 400,000 non-affiliated and independent voters. During the last year, the party has welcomed 10,000 new members. We are the only political party to gain members during 2007. We've attracted both civic and community leaders, including former Eugene Mayor Jim Torrey, NEA Director John Frohnmayer, and Congressman Jim Weaver, and others. I'd like to congratulate the committee for giving thought to moving this system of fusion voting here in Oregon forward. The Independent Party strongly endorses fusion, and as someone who's involved in the recruitment of independent candidates, I can say unequivocally that the party would rather fuse with the major political parties in support of independent-minded candidates rather than running the risk of spoiling an election for one or the other of the major parties. We do not believe that our members, nor the voters of this state, nor our system of representative government is well served if the only role for independent candidates is that of spoiler. Our current system, or any system in which third-party candidates are primarily relegated to the role of spoiler, is broken. We believe that it's contributing to voter apathy, to the disillusionment of voters towards the legislature, and to the disillusionment of voters towards both major political parties. A poll published in the Oregonian in December of 2007 indicated that only 30% of Oregonians hold a favorable impression of the state legislature. That's the lowest level of satisfaction ever given for such a survey. A July Gallup poll commissioned by USA Today indicates that 57% of Americans do not feel well represented by either major political party. Underlying this is a deeper issue. The problem is not that political parties do a poor job of advocating for citizens. The problem is that people do not feel well represented by our current system of elections. And in some ways, it's easy to see why. In Oregon, fewer than 10 out of 75 legislative races during any given election cycle are competitive races between the two major parties. Given the relative lack of participation by voters during the primary season, many general election outcomes are determined by fewer than 15% of voters who choose the winning candidate in a partisan primary. When you overlay that with Oregon's 60% voter registration, it becomes clear that in a majority of districts, 10% of the voting age population is choosing the winning legislative candidate in nearly 90% of the races. The result, we believe, is a deepening polarization of politics in Oregon. There is a hardening of positions and a campaign season that extends throughout the legislative session. We believe that this contributes to the disenfranchisement of many voters in this state and contributes to public apathy with regard to our political process. So let's take a look at this spoiler issue. Spoiler candidates have caused the defeat of Republican nominees for governor twice in the last 20 years. In 1990, Al Mobley picked up 13% of the vote in a three-way race, helping Barbara Roberts to get elected over Dave Frohnmeyer with 45% of the vote. In 2002, Tom Cox picked up 4.5% of the vote, helping Governor Kulongoski to defeat Kevin Mannix 49-46. And current polling suggests that John Frohnmeyer may drive between 15 and 25% of the vote in the race for U.S. Senate, running on the independent ticket. During the 2006 election, third-party candidates were recruited to run in several contested state legislative races. In House races, there were two candidates who ran as Greens, four candidates who ran as members of the Constitution Party, and 10 Libertarians. In total, third-party candidates were present in 16 out of 30 races. We believe that spoilers played a role in as many as a quarter of those races. The pattern was similar in 2004. Spoiler candidates probably played a role in the Democrats taking House Districts 32 and 35 and nearly tipped the balance in House Districts 50 and 54. In an era where we have an evenly divided House, one can easily make the case that the balance has been tipped as a result of third-party spoiler candidates. Now, the traditional way that the major parties have addressed the spoiler issue has been to pass laws to make it more difficult to put spoiler candidates on the ballot, or to make it less attractive for voters to pick someone who might be a spoiler. So in 2005, the law was changed to make it more difficult for independent candidates to get on the ballot, and a law was passed saying that independent candidates could only be listed on the ballot as non-affiliated rather than as independents. Fusion voting offers us a different way of moving forward. Rather than locking minor political parties out of the process, fusion gives them an opportunity to collaborate with the major political parties on a platform and agenda that strengthens all sides while encouraging candidates to reach out to minor political parties to win their nomination. Instead of recruiting spoiler candidates, fusion creates an incentive for minor parties to recruit candidates who are palatable to a broader segment of the public and encourages such candidates to reach out and win multiple nominations. Fusion also helps to differentiate candidates in the minds of voters. A Republican candidate who also represents the Constitution Party on its ballot line would be viewed differently than a Republican candidate with a ballot line for the Libertarians or for the Independents. We can see how strategically candidates can align with one or more major parties in an effort to broaden their appeal. This movement represents an opportunity to increase voter participation and could serve to improve voter attitudes towards both major political parties and their candidates. And finally, fusion voting gives us a new tool for measuring the marketplace of ideas coming out of a campaign. The strength of showing for a minor political party, particularly an ideological one like the Libertarians or Working Families Party or the Greens or Constitution Party, can help us to gauge the kind of mandate that a candidate is elected with. A candidate with 25% of his support from the Libertarian ballot line has a different kind of mandate than a candidate who is not on that ballot line or who is on the ballot line for another minor party. In summary, the Independent Party supports fusion voting as a vehicle to encourage collaboration between major and minor parties, to reduce instances of spoiler campaigns, and to help increase voter participation in and satisfaction with Oregon's system of election and Oregon government. Thanks for this hearing and for taking the time to hear my comments again. And with your permission, I'll pass on further comments.
Questions, comments? Senator Farrelly. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. I'm going to bring up Claire Crawford and Cappy Eaton for this panel. And then for the next panel, I'd like Mr. Lindback and Ms. Newingham. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you, Senators, for having this hearing.
I spoke quickly, I think, at the last hearing, so I'll try to be succinct instead this time. So my name is Claire Crawford. I'm the director of the National Open Ballot Project, which is a nonpartisan research organization that favors the revival of fusion voting. So we recently commissioned a study to examine the costs and technical implications of the implementation of fusion voting in various states, since several legislatures are actually considering this reform. The major findings of our study were basically that the implementation of fusion voting would not be substantially difficult to administer, that fusion voting does not cause significant voter confusion, that fusion voting does not impact the number of parties that qualify for ballot status, so it does not cause an increase in ballot clutter, and that the implementation of fusion voting should not be prohibitively expensive. I think the costs we covered pretty extensively in the last hearing, and I'm sure there'll be other testimony, and I think Professor Dudley also referred to what we view as a viable solution to keeping the costs low and simple. But on the other points, on fusion voting not being substantially difficult to administer, we had testimony at the last hearing from the Norwalk, Connecticut County Clerk, who has, obviously extensive experience implementing elections with fusion voting. They had software that can count the any double votes and needed no additional staff. He experienced no confusion from voters. So it was both easy to administer and did not cause confusion among the voters. On the issue of voter confusion, in the course of our research, we actually interviewed elections officials from four states that have fusion voting: South Carolina, New York, Delaware, and Connecticut. I think probably in all four states, all elections officials said that there was none or very insignificant episodes of voter confusion around fusion voting. And I think Delaware and South Carolina are probably the most relevant for Oregon, because in both of those states, although fusion voting has been on the books for since they've been using modern elections, it has not been widely used. In South Carolina, it's been used occasionally and recently been revived. And in Delaware, although it's been on the books, it has not been used for dozens of years, tens of years, and was recently used in an election. And in both of those states, they made no expense to educate voters on fusion voting, and they all in extensive interviews said that they did not experience confusion on the part of the voters, nor a large number of double votes, which would be another indication of people being confused. On the issue of the cluttered ballot, some people have expressed concern that a lot of additional parties will get created if fusion voting is on the ballot. That just has not been the case in the states that we looked at. Oregon has 7 parties currently qualified. New York only has 5, and New York's been the most active fusion voting state in the country. The state that has the most parties on the ballot is Florida, with between 20 and 25 parties. So the real factor in what determines the clutter of the ballot based on the number of parties is more what the state's regulations are in order to become a qualified party rather than who they're allowed to endorse. And then finally, on the issue of ballot clutter, I mean, California probably has one of the longest ballots, and that's really, and they do not have fusion voting. It's really more a factor of the number of ballot initiatives that they have, which obviously Oregon does have, and that's a much bigger contributor to how long the ballot is rather than who parties can endorse. So that's my brief summary. Thank you.
Thanks. Ms. Eaton, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kappa Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And I am here not because the League has a position on fusion voting, but because as you're looking at new kinds of ballot methods and different kinds of elections, we want to ensure that voters are adequately educated. While I hear what you are saying, we find that when we talk to people about fusion voting, people that we understand what's going on with elections, and they say, what in the world is fusion voting? So all we want to do, and we are in the midst of a study of alternative election methods, and we expect to finish our research this summer and have a publication in the fall to reach some kind of position with regard to all kinds of different methods. But in the meantime, we would simply want to encourage you to recognize that there, we feel, should be a a responsibility both at the state level, the elections division, and in the counties as they run elections, that they ensure that people do understand when you have such things as fusion voting, instant runoff voting, other kinds of election methods that people don't always understand. We just want to point that out to you, and there may be some costs involved with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either one of these two? Thank you very much. All right. Jan Coleman, Annette Newingham, and John Lindback. Welcome. Good to see you. Okay, give me a mic. Yeah. Looks like I'll start off. This is Annette Newingham from Lane County. I'm the elections official for Lane County. And members, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, this testimony is in opposition to Senate Bill 1102 on behalf of the Lane County Board of Commissioners. The Lane County Board of Commissioners is strongly opposed to unfunded mandates, and there would be significant costs to upgrade ballot counting as well as ongoing election costs as well. County clerks and election officials conduct elections on behalf of federal, state, county, city, district contests. All partisan offices that appear on the ballot in Lane County are federal and state. There are other counties that do have some partisan offices, however. The state does not reimburse Oregon counties for the state's apportioned election expenses at primary and general elections. I've outlined here for just specific to Lane County, and the upfront cost to upgrade for our county, which is documented on the attachments, is $421,840. The license fee that's noted there is likely would be there'd be some ongoing license fees, but I don't have the specific fees that would be on an annual basis. Right now, we pay $10,000 for what we have on an ongoing basis. The ongoing other biannual related costs, which is also of concern, is, well, we would have to do a voter outreach, I believe, every 2 years because it's not on every ballot, and people forget and you get new voters. I think that's important. Postage increase for longer or multiple ballots, and I estimated that at $10,000 because we now have rates where a larger envelope or with higher weight would actually increase the cost. Ballot printing when multiple ballots, and I estimated that at $50,000 based on having two for every voter. Adding the same ballot candidates multiple times represents different parties for partisan offices, would lengthen ballots or require multiple ballot pages. And we talked about the postal rate, so I'm not going to repeat myself, try to be a little bit more concise. But one of the things also the Lane County Board of Commissioners is concerned about is the voter confusion. It is definitely a concern, and fusion voting would likely increase it. I would like to point out to the documentation that's attached some examples of ballots of what we've experienced on a basis today. And it's not because people are uneducated by any means, but when you reach out to the public at hold, you reach all kinds of levels of understanding, and people do get confused currently. And you'll see that there's different types of things that they do wrong, whether it's, in our case, we use arrows, and they might circle the front, or they might list the person twice or overvote the same person's name. They do a lot of things. Last election, in 2006, Lane County had a very emotional Lane County measure, and we had 11,000 ballots that we had to hand process. And I do want to clarify from previous testimony that's not hand counting these ballots. It is actually hand processing. We have to pull them out. We have to look at them. We have to figure out the voter intent, and we either enhance or duplicate them. It took me a week in my county to process 11,000 ballots. So there is a reality to time, which costs money with staff and such. And voters will, the one thing that hasn't been really discussed is that when you have multiple, I put a ballot together. This is actually one of the other counties sort of did this for if you had
partisan offices with different party representations and multiple times listing, and this might be an over-exaggeration, which likely is, but still it does sort of point out that you don't really know which party that person really is to begin with. You are, and that will cause some questions from people saying, well, what are they? Are they a Republican or a Democrat, or are they a nonpartisan, or who, you know, what is their party affiliation, which is different than historically we have denoted the name behind a general election ballot. And fusion voting would require complex program changes. And if you go to hand counting or hand processing, that's still very complex. People have to make decisions along the way as to voter intent. And I want to point out that we election officials, are oftentimes facing many questions from the voters as a whole, because they're concerned about the complexities of elections and they want to understand things and be straightforward, and they suspect that we're not doing things straightforwardly to them, and we have to reassure them all the time. So the more complex something becomes, the more difficult it is to reassure voters. If multiple ballot pages are required, the reconciliation and audit of counted ballots against ballots received would increase in complexity. And Multnomah County did have a circumstance where they had multiple ballot pages, and it is more difficult because if a voter votes only one page and only returns one versus the two, then how do you know if you've got all the ballots? Did you misplace them? It's problematic. It's not undoable, but it slows it down, and it can also lead to possibly people thinking there are problems. So it's something we need to just consider. And I talked about the voter and with the examples with the type of ballots. Ultimately, the manual counting of the ballots or the processing will increase costs, slow down ballot counting, and ultimately slow down the results released to the public. I was fortunate enough not to have in the 2006 election anything that was close enough that I had people knocking on my door as to why it was taking so long for me to give, why, you know, 11,000 ballots is a lot. Mm-hmm. And I would be concerned if that number was increased and having a very close race. Lane County Board of Commissioners urges your opposition to this bill on the basis of unfunded mandates and changes and ongoing costs and changes that potentially increase voter confusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and today I'm representing the Association of County Clerks. Annette has said things very well. A couple things I want to address from previous testimony. I think they were using our fiscal from the last legislative session, and we have redone that and revisited it. We actually have one whole new voting vendor in the state, and that happens to be mine. But we haven't been able to even come up with a fiscal for them to update the software. There is some question of whether they even have that in their system at this time, because it's only handled straight party voting previously.
Ms. Coleman, can you tell us who the vendor is?
The vendor is Hart InterCivic.
Okay.
Annette and I both included some ballots. We traditionally were the predecessor to Sequoia, which was Business Record System, then purchased by ES&S. That part of ES&S has been now discontinued. The support for that software has been discontinued. So people like us that had that system for 20 years have had to go to something different. But you can see from traditional ballots, people do have trouble voting. Education is very, very important, and it's just something you can't ignore, and it's highly going to be costly. Annette's done a really good analysis, and the analysis here that we've come up with just Sequoia counties, because that's where we had the most information, would be probably $1 million to implement just the Sequoia counties. There are four small counties and one large county.
Okay.
ESNS is the largest vendor in the state, and then there are two counties now with Hart Interscivic. The thing we also don't know, too, is with the increased amount of candidates, we undoubtedly are going to have increased cost with just the printing of the ballots. So while you may say, oh, it's not going to increase too much, and if we even did the hand count, we still are going to be paying a lot more if we have to increase ballot pages. In my county, if I have to pay $10,000 for ballots, which is a common thing for a smaller ballot, I'm looking at as much as twice that now. So if this would increase the amount of people on the ballot, it's just a given. So there are a lot of costs out there that are in addition to even if you did a hand count. Increased ballot cost, definitely education, and probably our hand count would be more than this if you really came down to it.
Thank you. Mr. Lindback.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I'm here just to talk about two subjects in regards to this legislation. One, Secretary Bradbury believes that education is vitally important when you make a fundamental change to ballots, and would not want to downplay the importance of that, and reiterated that to me this morning when I discussed the subject with him. He also is of the opinion that this should not affect ballots. If the legislature wants to go forward with this legislation, should not affect ballots this year.
In 2008,
correct. Okay. Feels very strongly about that. So I just wanted to pass along those two.
Okay.
Those two things.
Thank you. Just a couple quick questions in terms of a follow-up. The bill with the Dash 1 amendments goes into effect January 2009. If we were to exempt the 08 election cycle, does it make sense to start it earlier in terms of the educational component, or do you think that starting in January 09 is adequate time?
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure I understand the question. Starting the education effort in January of 2009?
No, the bill with the Dash 1 amendments would go into effect January of 2009.
Right, so it would affect elections in 2009?
Correct. Well, right. There's not a general. We've got a general in November.
Right. And it only applies to general elections, right?
It's just special.
Well, special.
Special general.
Yeah. Right. So, I think that is enough. And that is enough time to educate. I'm not sure we'd want to start right away in January of 2009. I think we'd probably want to time it a little closer to the election.
Okay.
I think that we can educate the voters. It's a doable project given some resources, and that it needs to be sort of a multifaceted effort that involves some advertising along with work in the voter's pamphlet and the ballot packets.
And is the Secretary of State in support of the bill if it goes into effect and if it doesn't impact this 08 election cycle?
He told me that if I was asked that question today, I should pass on that he is neutral on the bill if it goes into effect after 2008 and is adequately funded in terms of education.
Okay. Questions, please, Chris? Senator Ferriello.
Just a couple statements and then an observation or two. First of all, I don't think the opportunity comes around nearly often enough to thank the folks who are elected public officials who serve all Oregonians in the county clerk's role. If you've ever dropped by the county courthouse during election season or seen the chaos that's under tight control there, it's pretty miraculous. I just wanted to express my appreciation for the work that all 36 county clerks do and the Secretary of State's office. The county clerks apparently made a suggestion that shows up in a couple of different letters that I've received, one from Deborah DeLong from the Malheur County clerk, who's also the president of the association this year. And it's a very simple suggestion. I'd like to read a very sure. brief sentence, if I have permission, Madam Chair. If the goal is to communicate that the candidate for an office has been endorsed by more than one party, the logical and cost-effective answer would be simply to list the names of those parties who endorsed that particular candidate after the candidate's name for an office on the ballot. And that suggestion apparently was made by the Clerks Association, that you could simply add one line or two line or three lines of type under or adjacent to the candidate's name showing those party endorsements. What happened to your suggestion, if I might ask?
Annette Newingham, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli. I don't think that really went real far other than we sent the email. We haven't had a lot of time to communicate on this. This session's a little bit odd for us. Sorry.
Believe me, it's odd for us, too. So,
but I think it's a workable compromise for sure. It's definitely better than the alternative of having the same candidate listed multiple times. It does take up more space on the ballot, but less space than the suggestion, the way having the same candidate with the different names on. So I think that the clerks would be always willing to discuss that.
What's your opinion about whether or not there'd be extensive voter education costs and reprogramming costs and software costs if your suggestion was followed?
I'm not sure exactly what the question. Are you saying as far as? I'm sorry. I should.
Well,
be
let
sure
me rephrase,
what the question
ma'am,
is.
Ma'am, if I can re-ask the question. If what we did was simply list all the party affiliations or all the party endorsements that were made, would we have to reprogram the computers or spend a lot of money on educating voters?
Thank you, Senator Farioli, Madam Chair. Yes, I think that you would definitely have to have it voter education. It would be imperative at any point that we make any changes in the elections process. You cannot underemphasize the need for education. You need the education when you don't change anything, much less if you change something. We're getting calls today asking where people's ballots are because it's Super Tuesday. So it doesn't matter at what point. You're always going to have people that are new into the system. You're always going to have people that move in from other states. You always are having change. And even if it's the same person that's lived there for 20 years, we get questions that you can't even imagine that they would even be asking. But that's just the nature of what we're supposed to do. And I think voter education has to be intricate into everything we process. So it would be very important if we make a change.
Madam
Chair. Senator Farioli.
It was intimated by folks, and this is a question for
didn't answer this off.
Ms. Newingham. It was intimated by somebody who offered testimony earlier that there would be only a handful of additional parties that would be added. I was just wondering, in Lane County, whether you had any sense for how many independent parties might come forward to become organized to nominate their candidates. Do you have any idea?
Senator Farioli, Madam Chair, it's somewhat of a crystal ball answer because I do know that Oregon is very likes change, likes new ideas, and is open to those things, and that's a good thing. That's why we have vote by mail. So there's a positiveness in that sense. And I also think that many might take advantage of this because of the novelty of it. So we should be prepared for a busy ballot. We take advantage of the initiative process to a great extent. I think to underestimate it would be an error on our part. If it's less, well, okay, but we usually don't find that we have less work than we expected. It's usually a reverse.
Madam Chairman, I can see in a politically active community a couple dozen parties being organized, and I can see a ballot where an individual candidate might have their name on the ballot, you know, not just once or twice or five or six, but maybe 10 or 15 times, depending on you know, their popularity and ability to get small parties organized. And Madam Chairman, I can see this becoming a mechanism for using the ballot as a campaign tool. Well, I was nominated 20 times, Madam Chair. That could happen. And I heard testimony here earlier that I thought was really wisdom. I don't know that we should use the ballot, which many people hold as a sacred right as citizens, to be used in that political manner, and possibly even as a way to recruit to a party who's trying to get off the ground or to grow. So, you know, the first thing you want to do is get your nominee on the ballot. That shows that you're a party. I don't think the ballot should be used as a recruitment tool. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator Farrelly. I'm sure someone can address that fact. I don't think it's been a problem in New York that there have been so many parties they don't have room for that. But I'll let someone speak to that. I do think what it does is give the opportunity for voter engagement, and I think that's critically important. So either Ms. Newingham or Ms. Coleman, you have some really good information regarding the software upgrades, and this, lucky for everyone in the room, I guess, this is not the committee that deals with the financial impacts of the legislation. So, but my question for you is, are the software upgrades, are they dealing, is that to deal with the overvote issue?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, this is actually to enable being able to count where the same candidate is listed and can tally separate tallies and bring them together.
Okay.
It's not, I don't even know if the overvote, that the way it's designed for my election system, actually would be able to deal with that overvote process. We might still have to, they'd either have to upgrade it or deal with that issue, or we'd have to hand process those still. There is some question.
Okay. All right. Anything else from this panel? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you much.
Okay, let's bring up Alex Aronson, Jake Oliver, and Ted Hughes on behalf of Jeff Krupp. And I think you two young men were, come on, you guys can come up, it's fine. Got to testify while we were in Gresham, and But I think it's important to have you participate, and so we're going to make you do that today again. And Mr. Hughes, I know you've had the opportunity to participate, so.
Yes, I do, Matt. I just briefly, if you don't mind, gentlemen, can you let me go?
Go right ahead.
Thank you. I have their permission, Madam Chair and members of the committee, to speak first. You have my handout, and the reason I'm here is because the signature at the bottom of it, you will not be able to figure out. I couldn't. And it's signed by ex-representative Jeff Krupp. So I wanted to point that out to you. When you get that handout, you'll say, who is that? And I wanted to make that very clear. In his testimony to you, he points out that in 2005, he was one of the principal sponsors of this measure. It passed the House 49-2 and strangely disappeared in the Senate. But the telling thing about his handout is the next to last paragraph where it says, governing well means building upon those areas of common agreement and producing policy for those we serve. Fusion voting helps achieve that goal because by its very nature, it facilitates and encourages people to work together. I think that's a great comment. I may steal it from him and use it on other things as we move through the session. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. All right.
Chairman Brown, committee members, thank you very much for holding this hearing and for this opportunity to testify before you. My name is Alex Aronson. I am the Youth Vote Director at the Oregon Bus Project, and I'd like to talk to you about why I think fusion voting could solve or help solve our state's young voter turnout problem. In 2006, I was the lead organizer for Building Votes, which was the Bus Project's statewide voter registration and engagement project. We had face-to-face conversations with over 50,000 Oregon voters, young voters, and we registered over 20,000 of them. It was one of the biggest young voter registration efforts in the state and in the country, in fact. And in my capacity as an organizer of that project, I registered over 2,000 young Oregonians to vote myself. And I think that might actually be a state record. That's a lot of conversations with young people about voting and about politics. It's a lot of debates, it's a lot of arguments in Pioneer Square with angry anarchists talking about why voting is important. And given these conversations, I feel like I have some confidence in saying that we have a challenge when it comes to young voters in Oregon. In 2004, if you look at the numbers, Oregon had the biggest differential of any state in the country between overall turnout and youth voter turnout. It was a staggering 28-point gap in between those two groups. And I think what that shows you largely is that vote by mail is working very well for Oregon's voters. Consistently, we're ranking in the top 5 or 6 in the country in overall turnout, but it's not working for young people. So there are some structural problems that are keeping young people from turning out to the polls. We move around a lot. We don't have stamps. A lot of times we don't even get our ballots. So I think there are clearly some fundamental structural problems to address in terms of access to the ballot for young folks. But while structural impediments certainly play a role, I think both nationally and in Oregon, the biggest problem remains attitudinal. Young people aren't buying into the political process. And you read what you want about the MySpace generation and the revolution of the political spirit of America's youth. But when I'm out on the street and when I'm talking to young people, they're not engaged. And they're not engaged in politics, and they're certainly not engaged in local politics. So what is keeping young folks from voting? I think there's a lot of reasons. I think one of the big reasons is that campaigns, since they can't trust young people to turn out, don't direct their resources towards them. There's a lack in general of education about the political process. And there's the fact, as I mentioned above, that we have structural problems about youth access to the polls with vote by mail. But perhaps most importantly, and I really want to hit this home, there is a disconnect from political partisanship, and there is a distrust of the status quo and of the system. There is a prevailing sense that young people's voices just don't matter. I talk to people on the street, they say, why should I vote? It doesn't matter. I only have one vote. They don't even count it. I really want to reiterate that. There is a clear sense among young people that government is not representing their interests. And why would they vote if they don't feel like their vote counts? So why fusion voting? Most convincing to me is the idea that fusion voting makes politics and elections about people, you people, good people, policies and ideas, and not about political parties, which young people simply don't trust, and a lot of people don't trust, not just young people. The simple ability to support a candidate without also lending a tacit endorsement of a major political party is a very convincing thing, and I believe it will resonate strongly with the young folks that we talk to out on the street when they're weighing their decision to participate in government and the civic process. If you look at survey data from fusion legal states, it demonstrates that fusion-based parties have special appeal to young voters and voters that have limited partisan identification. Because fusion voters gives voters both this opportunity to cast an expressive vote that reflects their issue priorities and also support a major party candidate that has a real chance of winning, it provides the opportunity for disengaged young people to get involved in this process in a significant and a constructive fashion. Clearly, as I referred to before, I don't think fusion voting is the overall answer. I think it needs to be part of a comprehensive effort on the part of the legislature and other public bodies to make electoral systems that work for young people. Thanks so much for your time, and happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Okay, I covered a lot of what I wanted to talk about in Gresham, so I'll keep it brief. Madam Chair and committee members, I'd like to thank you for having me back again and talking about the effort to restore fusion voting in Oregon. My name is Jake Oliver. I recently graduated from college and I'm a former organizer with the Working Families Party in Connecticut and New York. I feel like I sort of have a unique perspective here on what organizing is like in states where fusion voting is more popular, and you know, I'm thankful to be here and be able to answer any questions and concerns you might have. I am involved in the political process because New York has fusion voting. As a college sophomore, I was really interested in policy and, you know, seeing legislation get done, but I didn't feel like I identified with the Democratic or Republican Party. The idea of a Working Families Party appealed to me because I squared with their ideology. It allowed me to send a vote and work for an organization that reflected my values as a civic participant while not playing the role of spoiler. We need young voters to participate in the process. We need people engaged. My generation is going to be forced with addressing issues like climate change, like addressing poverty, fixing Social Security and Medicare. We can't do that with an apathetic generation. We need people who are on the ball paying attention to the issues and holding politicians accountable. According to the University of Maryland study, which Alex mentioned, we do have one of the largest gaps between young and older voter rates, and I feel Fusion is an excellent way to start addressing this problem. It allows young people to send in a ballot that reflects their values. It gives us a greater degree of choice and allows us to send a message to candidates and major political parties without playing the role of spoiler. And it also gives us a voice and lets us know that someone in the political arena is fighting for the values that we hold dear. Once again, thanks for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, Jake, because you're from New York, you're going to get the question then. Senator Farioli expressed the concern that there were going to be 863 parties on the ballot. Has that been a problem in New York?
In New York in 2006, I was up in Connecticut at the time, but we had the Republicans on Ryan A, Democrats on B, the Independence Party on C, Conservative Party on D, Working Families Party on E, and I believe the Greens were somewhere on the ballot, but they don't engage in Fusion as much. It's been my experience that we've added parties that don't engage in Fusion, that those are the parties that have been added, and I think the best example of that is the famous Connecticut's for Lieberman Party in Connecticut. Most of the sort of add-ons have been people who have not been engaging in Fusion.
Senator Farioli, any...
Oh, Madam Chairman, I wasn't worried about the state parties. I was worried about just in Lane County, they're going to have 24 new parties.
Alex, maybe, could be. Alex, my question for you is the issue of Senator Farioli's suggestion, the one that he talked about with the clerks, is that you would have the candidate's name and all of the party's endorsements after that candidate's names. I guess my question to you, does that really solve the problem of focusing on the issues, not the parties, and just any comments you might have along those lines?
You know, I think it's better than what we have now, but I don't think it fully goes to where Fusion does in that lending the capacity to give that expressive vote, that kind of issue-based vote that you mentioned. A big part of the Fusion solution is that voters can send a message with their vote. When I elect you, you can see that, you know, if I say I elect you as a working families representative, you know that 30% of your votes came from people that had the values of the Working Families Party. And if you combine all those parties together, then it doesn't have that, you know, constructive effect.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chairman, you're doing all my question asking. With your permission, I'll just toss a couple out there.
Go ahead, Senator Farioli.
I'm concerned that this is just a further extension of the niche politics, the sort of stratification of markets and the micro-targeting that we see that's prevalent in national and local politics today. How is this not going to essentially... contribute to sort of a boutique politic approach? I can't package this person as a major party member, but maybe I can package him a little bit differently and get an endorsement, and if I can do that four or five times, I can get my candidate's name on the ballot more than my opponent's candidate. How do you respond to that? Either one of you gentlemen, jump in.
You guys are doing great so far.
I only can speak from my experience with the Working Families Party, but I felt that in New York we had a broad coalition of people from all across the political spectrum, geographically, socioeconomically, racially, and that was something that we were proud of, and able to sort of bring people together to focus on moving particular legislation, and I think... the biggest thing, the first initial victory of the party was working on raising the minimum wage and bringing a broad coalition of Democrats and Republicans together, people from all across the state, and even controversially endorsing a couple Republicans in swing districts, one of which won by 17 votes. So I think it takes away from polarization. It brings people together to work on the common ground.
Thank you, Mary. Any other questions?
Madam Chairman, I do have additional questions, but I'll perhaps talk to these gentlemen offline.
These are pretty good. These guys are pretty good.
Well, it's great, but I guess the thing that occurs to me, Madam Chair, do any of these minor party nominees that are not major party nominees, if you follow what I'm saying, ever get elected?
There is one member of the New York City Council that I know off the top of my head, in a very, what was considered a very safe Democratic seat in downtown Brooklyn, who actually ran against a Democrat in the general election and won. So it talks about the choice. The minor parties can choose to cross endorse, or they can choose to run their own candidate. So they can have real impact in many different ways. Fusion just gives parties, voters, and politicians an option.
Thank you. All right. Alex, you want
actually,
to respond to
I think Senator Brown and Senator Farioli, I think actually one of the goals of the whole thing is that, you know, we want to work towards a political system where there aren't two, you know, set in stone parties, where the people running on minor party tickets are not fringe candidates, where these people can actually represent major voting blocks. I think looking towards the future, that's one way we could think of this.
Well, here I'm sure I look at some of the European democracies. Italy comes to mind. 59 governments in 56 years because of fusion candidacies. And if you look at that system, it's very chaotic. So this sounds too good to be true.
Thank you. We appreciate you all joining us.
Madam Chair, if I may, thank you for calling me up with these two gentlemen here on my right. I appreciate that.
It was purely accidental.
Also, on the cost, I wanted to say, Representative Krupp told me that he'd been in contact with a software company, and they said a $200 software package would take care of this. And I'm sorry, I do not have what company or his letter to that regard, but it didn't sound very expensive and complicated that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on Fusion? Ms. Thompson, come on up.
Madam Chair, while Ms. Thompson comes up, there is no computer program that costs $200.
Good afternoon.
Okay. All right.
Janice Thompson with Lancaster Fair Morgan. Testifying in support of the bill and go on to repeat any previous arguments, will note the bipartisan support. I'm mainly coming up, however, to suggest a need to look at some of the issues about education and ballot design from a whole different angle. I would argue that what we really have is a pre-existing need for improvements in ballot design and education. And that I think one indication of that is that the Elections Division at the state level has really done pioneering work in design improvements to forms and manuals. And I would just argue that that's the kind of attitude that should just be ongoing and would benefit ballot design, period, much less ballot design in a setting where the ballot could potentially look a little different. Similarly, in terms of education, I think it's important to note the Secretary of State has done education campaigns in the past. For example, in the spring of 2002, there was a whole voter awareness campaign related to signature gathering fraud. And so, you know, the resources have been found in the past for these kinds of efforts. And that example and some others might be helpful in terms of, you know, sorting out the fiscal. But again, I think the need for any voter education pertaining to any alternative voting method really needs to be viewed as one component of a broader effort, ongoing effort to educate voters about any number of issues. Things like, you know, remember to update your address with the county elections office, voter registration deadlines, location of vote drop boxes. So I think that if we kind of shift our thinking to, like, our default mode should be more education, not less, then the implications of just adding one more factor in that education effort, I think, and that's just the way to think about it. That's all I wanted to add to the discussion.
All right. Professor Dudley, did you want to come? Hang on just a second, Jess. I just wanted to make a comment that you don't think the League of Women Voters can do the entire educational component and around this issue.
Do you? Me?
Yeah.
I wouldn't presume to speak for the League of Women Voters.
Come on up, Professor Dudley. There needs to be a broader education effort, and we can't rely on one civic organization to do it, is what your comment is.
Right, and that it's not just on this issue.
I didn't want to give Cappy a heart attack.
Right,
so.
No. I think my main point, though, is not, kind of regardless of who's doing it, is that we need to recognize that we need be doing more education in the whole arena of needs to kind of make sure voters are up to speed on it on a number of things. And that just puts, I think, adding this, the education needs on this one particular issue, I think needs to be viewed as being part of a bigger context.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Vakian, Professor Brad Dudley. Go ahead. One of you. Go.
I just wanted to speak to the question of the number of parties that will appear on the ballot. And I was struck by the analogy between Italy and Lane County, which I think is possibly accurate. But
being an anarchist state,
no comment. But I do want to point out that the fusion voting bill that's before you, Senate Bill 1102, does nothing to change the requirements for a party to get on the ballot. And, in fact, what the experience has been, and the reason the numbers are smaller in New York State than they are in California, for example, of the number of parties, I don't actually know for a fact about California, but Florida, is because voters prefer to vote on a fusion ticket where they will actually be supporting a candidate who has a chance to win than to vote as a spoiler or possibly a wasted vote. And so the number of what you refer to as fringe parties tends to drop off because people don't go there as a way to express their opinions. They will instead go to a party that can actually cross-endorse a major party candidate who may have a chance of winning, and yet you still can say, but I believe in the values of the Working Families Party, and I want to be sure that candidate X does too, or at least knows that I do, and knows that I am one of his supporters. So that's the key to it, by the way, what they have in Europe is slightly different, but I would refer you to other European countries that also have proportional representation and do not have the same problems Italy does. If you go further north, it gets more stable.
Senator Vakian.
Some places only have one party.
They do, that's right, and that's real stability.
I was just thinking of the list of Republican statewide office holders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple times the notion of does this really give minor parties a chance to win or not has come up, and I just wanted to make a comment about that. Certainly part of the intent of the bill is to put more parties in a position to be able to participate by winning. Actually, over 100 years ago, when Oregon did vote this way, we had 12 minor party representatives in the legislature at one time. But the greater intent of the bill is not to put minor parties in the position to win. It's based on what is really a quite democratic principle in this country, a core value, that whether or not you can win or be in the majority, that you have a right to be heard and a right to participate. And this secures that for minor parties better than the current system does. Thank you.
Thank you. All set. Thank you. All right. Appreciate you joining us yet again. We are waiting for Senator Monash Anderson so we can adopt our committee rules. And
We were waiting for to do.
Well, we did, and then she left. So I know you are all waiting with bated breath on what we're going to do on Senate bill. I'm like, what's the bill number?
1102.
1102. We can't do anything until Senator Monis Anderson comes back. The plan, the bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The chair is going to make another motion in hopes of giving the Senate president as much flexibility as possible in terms of this issue. But it is will as soon as it leaves our hands, it will be up to the certified smart people in legislative fiscal to come up with a fiscal impact statement, which we hope they will do in relatively short order. I know for the clerks that are here, don't panic. We will make sure that there is a fiscal done appropriately on this bill. That's the Secretary of State's office as well. Oh, here she is. Good. Perfect timing. Okay. So no one panic and no one get your hopes up too high is all I'm saying. We're trying to give the Senate president as much flexibility as possible. So we need to. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1102. We need to adopt our committee rules. We need to adopt the rules.
Madam Chairman?
Sarah Ferrioli.
I move the adoption of the Senate committee rules on Senate elections and ethics as drafted.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. I hope you've had the opportunity to review them thoroughly.
I haven't even looked at these rules.
All right.
If I objected to the rules, I perceive a definite two to one. in the interest of time.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. Senator Ferrioli has moved the adoption of the Senate committee rules for elections and ethics for the 2008 special session. Any further discussion? Any objection? You're not going to object to your own motion now, are you?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
But I would serve notice. No, I
you can't.
I don't have any members here.
Right. Hearing and seeing no objection, the committee rules are adopted. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1102. I was just explaining to the audience that we're trying to give the Senate President as much flexibility as possible. And thank you, Ms. Taylor. The chair would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 1102, the amendments that Senator Avakian has requested. Any discussion?
I'm sorry. Could you restate the motion?
Sure. Now? I've moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 1102. Right here. It's pretty short.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
No objection.
No objection. So ordered. Make sure I get my language here right. The chair would move to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, I would object. And the reason I would object is that I think asking an expedited legislative fiscal treatment of this bill gives it a better chance to be fairly and reasonably considered by the body. Sending it to the president's desk means he'll have to go through a process to make the decision whether to refer it or not for a fiscal. And as you heard the testimony by the elections officials, they're very concerned about unfunded mandates and transferred costs. We also heard everything from $200 to $200,000 in terms of the cost, and I think we ought to get those certifiably smart people to narrow that number down to what it really might be. So I would push for the legislative fiscal. I will join you in asking for an expeditious fiscal to be prepared, but I would ask you not to strip the referral off so that we can get that work done early. This is the second day of the session.
Could we ask for rescinding the referral if there is no fiscal impact?
That was not my motion. That can certainly be. That's the net effect of the motion, because if there is a fiscal impact, the Senate President will send it to Ways and Means. Trust me. I've tried to work my way around that a number of times and have not ever been successful. So they're pretty consistent up there. So
if we...
The fiscal is actually in process at this point in time, and we will have a fiscal impact statement at the time the bill reaches the Senate President's desk. So...
Would it be possible to get this fiscal to this committee and then rehold the hearing and after everybody has a look at it, and then if the fiscal is, you know, under 50 or negligible?
It certainly would, and if we weren't closing next Tuesday, I would probably say we'd do that. But
Madam Chair, when are we expecting the fiscal? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that question. Ms. Taylor, do you know?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we could probably get a fiscal by Tuesday.
Next time.
Well, so. I'm sure it would be earlier. It's just that your committee wouldn't be able to meet until Tuesday.
Right.
Next Tuesday.
So.
Your call, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The motion was to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Senator Farioli,
no.
We noted as an objection, and the chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any, as amended. Thank you very much. Any further discussion? Senator Farioli?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, we will have Senator Vakian carry the bill. This may be the last, if the bill does go to Ways and Means, this may be the last public hearing on this bill in terms of the substance of the issue. So just want everybody to know that. Now the fight will move, if there is a fight, on the fiscal impact statement down to Ways and Means. So, all right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
I'm concerned not about this bill. But procedurally, if what we're trying to do with this supplemental session is gain the credibility of Oregon citizens, and this bill was pre-session filed, as all of our bills were, almost a month ago, we should have arrived here with the legislative analysis from fiscal to know what the cost is. And then we wouldn't essentially be flying blind. So I'm just going to say procedurally, the minority will speak to the procedures, not the substance of the bill. The procedure should not force us to vote aye or nay on a bill in the Senate floor wherein there is no identifiable cost estimates, no certainty about what it costs, whether we're just downstreaming the cost to the county elections officials or would have to prioritize, you know, the value of this program against other programs in a fiscal process. So, you know, substance of the bill aside, procedurally, I really strongly object to arriving here and moving the bill with a due pass recommendation to the floor, not knowing what the cost is.
Thank you. I appreciate your concerns and certainly hear them. And I do believe legislative fiscal is working as quickly as possible on all of the couple of hundred bills that have been introduced to get fiscals on them. Of course, we're hoping they're not working on bills that won't have fiscals and aren't moving forward. So we hope they're focusing on bills that are moving. So, all right, with that, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1102 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1071. Ms. Taylor, why don't you give us an overview of the bill? And thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill as drafted requires that out-of-state contributions on ORSTAR appear in different colored fonts than in-state contributions. And this is a committee bill. You have a dash one amendment.
Thank you. All right. All right. Now that we're losing all of our audience, I won't take it personally. Ms. Thompson, why don't you come on up?
Is this a gun stuff?
No. It is not a gun stuff. Pretty straightforwardly, this takes the online web-based reporting to the next level, the original bill, by identifying out-of-state contributions in colored font. So let me give an example. My grandfather sending me money from the state of Minnesota to support my campaign, he would be identified in a different color font than someone who sent me money for my campaign living here in Oregon. Or another example, I'm trying to think, 3M located in St. Paul. If they were to send a campaign contribution to you, Senator Farioli, that would be in one color. If the equivalent company, I'm trying to think, Intel, sent you a campaign contribution, it's probably not the best example, but Nike, for example, Nike, that would not be color-coded. So pretty straightforward. Ms. Thompson has requested an amendment. Ms. Thompson, why don't you explain your amendment?
Janice Thompson, Democracy from Oregon. I would characterize the Dash 1 amendments as pure housekeeping. In conversations with the Elections Division staff, I think I think it's fair to say that's how they would characterize it. Basically, the transition of chief petitioner committees into having to report via ORSTAR, there were a number of committees up and running during 2007 that filed reports in September. If those committees continue to make transactions after that deadline in 2007, but never make a 2008 transaction, those additional transactions aren't reported. They're kind of in disclosure limbo until, say, they close the the committee. So there's about 15 PACs in that category, not PACs, chief petitioner political committees. About 10 of them, as kind of everybody expected, is continuing the activity to 2008, and so, ORSTAR is now kicking everything in. But there are indeed about five that, haven't had any 2008 transactions, so it's just not quite clear if they're moving. So I think this is a very straightforward housekeeping amendment to just make sure that those small set of committees do the intended transition into ORSTAR.
Thank you. Question, Senator Farrielly.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not going to move this bill today.
What are the five committees?
I have the PAC numbers.
Mr. Neely, do you know the answer to the question?
I know the two that I'm going to file tonight.
Madam Chair, I just wondered how big the bread box is. If those five committees are known, I'd like to know them by name.
I have the committee numbers. It relates. One of them relates to initiative petition 2. I'll get back to you on that.
That's fine.
I'm sorry, I just don't have it right off the
top
of my head.
That's fine. I can take that information offline, Madam Chair.
Okay. And yeah. Janice, my other question is, we would assume that this amendment would have no fiscal impact. Speaking of the guy who does the numbers, or sort of does the numbers. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I think, Mr. Lindback, could you?
He missed that conversation.
Is there a fiscal to this?
No.
Amendment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Minimal fiscal.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Any questions for Janice? Mr. Neely, can I get you to come up? Since Mr. Lindback has walked into the room, he may not want to be part of this conversation, but... I asked Mr. Neely to come up. We had attempted to craft an amendment to address the issue he had raised in, I believe, our November committee hearing. It may have been December committee hearing regarding what happens when the ORSTAR system goes down. And we had trouble crafting an amendment to address the issue. Mr. Neely, could you talk about the issue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely, and I do CNEs, among other things, for a living. I own a company called CND Systems, oddly enough. Clever name. Right now, one of the concerns we have is we're unable to meet a deadline because there's a system flaw, what will happen is rather than just saying there was a system flaw and pushing it over to the next day or whatever that time limit's going to be, I think, again, we're still waiting to see how the penalties roll out of ORSTAR. I think what would happen by operation of the law is we would be found in violation of the law, and we would have to go in and we would have to make an affirmative argument that, in fact, there was a downtime that ORSTAR was unavailable. I am trying to avoid having to get that mean letter from the Secretary of State's office, and just it would automatically be the course that were your filing delayed because of that some sort of downtime, it would just there'd be an automatic extension for those committees who had deadlines of that day. Again, I do think, as the chair has said, I don't have strong feelings about how long that time period would be, but certainly it seems like the next day you ought to be able to file that. And if you can't get it done the next day, why, then you should get that mean letter and a fine. And Senator Farrielly, I could tell you that three of the committees that still have not filed, who are chief petitioner committees, are Oregon Open Primary, and Good for Oregon. And those are one of them, well,
Okay, that's three of the five. Thank you.
I don't know what
Any questions for Mr. Neely? So I asked Mr. Neely to come specifically address the issue because I'm hearing from folks that there is an issue when the system goes down. Mr. Lindback, do you want to respond to that? I did not have an amendment crafted because I didn't want to blow a hole through everything, and I wanted to keep it pretty narrow. Can you kind of respond to Mr. Neely's concerns? Or
Well, I've been asked this question, I believe, in the past, and my answer today is the same as what it's been in the past, and that when the new law was passed, it put into effect a section that said that mitigating factors included any problems with the adjustment from paper filing to electronic filing. We have used that section liberally to go lightly on fines. I do not see any justification for fining somebody if the system is down. I've never seen any justification, and I would have no intent of fining anybody if the fault is our fault. And I've been on the record on that numerous times. Would I object to an amendment that said that? No. But I don't really feel like it's necessary. But if people would feel better about that, I wouldn't object to an amendment that said that.
Sir Ferrioli.
I think, Mr. Lindback, you have to appreciate the fact that having an affirmative defense or a cause for an affirmative defense may keep you after a significant process from getting a fine. But you are going to spend money and time and effort making the affirmative defense when it would be, I think, far easier to say, to create an automatic process whereby there's a 24-hour extension following a system crash for deadlines. And just put it right out there so everybody knows it's there, and then
if folks would be comfortable with that, I'm fine with it.
And so my other question, obviously, if we put something in writing, you know, what parameters make sense? You know, how long does the is it, you know, what tips the delay? And that's the other tricky part. What I hear you saying is that you feel like you have the flexibility to deal with the issue. Sarah Ferrioli raised the issue of, you know, folks are concerned. So, you know, I think my question for you all, and, you know, we have like a week to kind of wrestle with this is, you know, do we want to put a specified time frame that the system has to be crashed, you know, and all that kind of stuff, or, you know, give the Secretary of State's office as much flexibility as possible?
You raise a wonderful issue, Madam Chair. If the system only crashes for an hour, you would think that a 24-hour extension would be extravagant.
Yes.
Unless it's the hour that you were trying
exactly.
to get
Exactly. Well, that's most
unless
very
it was 4 o'clock on the day of the filing, which, trust me, a lot of the folks working as campaign coordinators and treasurers are trying to get that work done in that last hour. So I would say a 24-hour isn't extravagant.
Mr. Lindback, go ahead.
I agree with that, and I think that needs to be well thought out and well discussed. I mean, the last time we went through something like this, we thought what looked like a good idea turned out to be something that's problematic, and that's the midnight deadline. Should actually be 11:59. Because midnight is the first moment of the next day, and it's created a lot of confusion out there among people. And
do we need to change that?
Well, that would be helpful.
Okay.
I think if we're going to go through and fix things, and if there's a vehicle to fix them, we'd like to fix that.
Okay. All right. So
somewhere far away, I hear squealing tires and tinkling glass.
Thank you. If for some reason it crashes on our end, and it's 11:50, not 11:59.
Crashes on our end, meaning the category's end and
states. No, not the state's end, but the individual's end.
Mm-hmm.
Your SOL. Yeah. But is there a stopgap where we could fax it or not? No. He's saying no.
Can I get back to an answer on that? He's saying no, but I don't think so. I think he's correct, but I'd like to double check.
Well, he's doing everybody. I have an individual that's doing mine. I missed that. He's not going to say no if he says yes.
Well, you know, I mean... We have, when we get into cases like this, and if it ends up in a case, and it ends up in a big deal, you know, one of the things we'd look at was, you know, were we in control of the information? Did we have it? It all could affect the size of a fine or no fine, or, you know, it depends. I mean, we look at these things and try to be reasonable. But I don't think that there's, I think he's correct, I don't think there's anything in law right now that says if you have a problem on your end, you can fax it to us.
In fact, I think it says that if you have a problem on your end, I mean, I'm not sure it's, I know it may say that in the manual.
Okay.
That if you have a problem on your end, I'm perfect. I think the 1159 thing is a good thing.
So we have we have a vehicle. We don't have a lot of time. I'm given that at this point in time, the bill doesn't look like with the Thompson amendments that it doesn't have a fiscal. That'll sort of be the kind of criteria that I'll want to use. But let's take a look at 1159. Let's take a look at system crashes and see if we can come to some kind of agreement and get something drafted here in the next few days.
And Madam Chairman, could you regress to the very beginning of this hearing? You mentioned this was not a get and stuff.
Correct.
And you described the function of the bill. The multicolored inks. And I just wondered if the intention of the chairman is to move the bill forward with those multicolored ink provisions still within the bill.
That would be my hope.
Well, Madam Chairman, I would ask simply to consider that any entity can create an Oregon PAC. And so if in the example that you used where Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, a.k.a. 3M Corporation, wanted to make an in-state contribution, all they would be to open a PAC in Oregon with an Oregon address, and their initial contribution to the Oregon PAC would be in one color ink, and their contributions from that PAC to candidates or committees to elect or whomever would be in the same color that all other Oregon PACs would be. So the workaround, Madam Chair, makes the bill obviously unnecessary.
Okay.
Just something I throw out there for
you. Okay, that's very helpful. That's good. Okay, this is why we have hearings on bills.
Right on.
So, all right. Anything else to come before the committee? You're just smiling away. You love that.
Let's get the same picture on day 20.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Anything further to come before the committee? I think we're back on tomorrow, same bat time, same bat location. All right. With that, we're adjourned. Drive carefully.
Madam Chair. Thank you.